Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, everyone. It is Monday night, and I know it's not your usual theme song, but we have a very unusual show. Tonight, we're having a show that's going to be dedicated to conservative views and values. I will not be participating, per se. I will be watching my Steelers on Monday Night Football. Your show is being recorded, so for everyone that is a member of the panel, or for anyone that calls in, the show is recorded, and all our rights remain intellectual property of Go Steelers Fan. With that, let's get this show started, and I will interview the host, my friendly antagonist, Nick, those of you that know anything about next door here in San Diego, me and Nick kind of go at it occasionally. I thought it would be good to listen to the other side. Everybody always says I'm kind of stubborn here, but hey, I'll listen to anybody. Nick, why don't you take over from here?
I'd be happy to. This will be the best show you've ever had. All right, so my name is Nick. I don't want to give too much autobiographical information. For one reason is you didn't tune in to listen to my history. You don't care about that. You want to hear some Republican put his foot in his mouth and say a bunch of stuff that you can say proves the point that all Trump supporters are, let me get this order right, racist, sexist, xenophobes. Forgive me if I got the order out of order. There is so much more to each one of these issues that is in the news these days. And the reason I started this group on Nextdoor called Left Meets Right is because we don't have enough discussions between the two ideologies. In other words, the two political parties, you know, we've always been kind of at odds. And I think there's a healthy divisiveness within Congress. You should have some friction. But what has happened this year especially is that it's become so polarizing that the two sides can't even get past the point of recognizing you're voting for Biden and I'm voting for Trump, and therefore that's where the conversation begins and ends. You're going to see this year around Thanksgiving, if you even go to the family members that you know are your ideological opposites, probably more tension than you've ever seen. There are marriages that are being dissolved because people disagree about Trump. There are lifelong friendships that are being terminated. Why do you think this is? One of the reasons is we are so polarized that we can't even begin to recognize A, that there is another side to these issues, and B, that the other side could have arguments just as legitimate as ours. So the goal tonight, which I fully respect James for doing, is to allow the other side to explain where we are coming from. It's easy for most of you who are listening to this, who are predominantly liberal to leftist, to assume that people like myself and Joe, who was on this call as well, are less informed, less intelligent, clearly racist, clearly xenophobic. And that is the logical assumption you would make if you've never had an interaction with someone like us, who is just as informed on the issues. And if we're not, then I would like you to educate us. We care about this country as much as you. I don't think you hate this country, even though it sure seems like it from us, from our standpoint. When I watch the news and I see people tearing down almost every facet of American history, the statues, breaking down, you know, the Star-Spangled Banner, there are problems with our past. Racism pervaded throughout every country in every part of the world when our country was founded. And it still pervades throughout many countries in the Middle East and our trading partner, China. But why do those countries get a pass? Why do they teach in schools, especially with the 1619 Project, all the atrocities our country is guilty of? Conservatives don't deny the history of this country. But what we do take issue with is the notion that the United States was founded not in 1776, but in 1619, when the first slaves arrived. I take issue with the one-sided narration of a very skewed perspective of American history that shows Americans were guilty of slavery almost in a vacuum. They don't put it into context that the slave trade treated not just blacks, but primarily blacks in this country as chattel, almost akin to how cattle, and understand the difference between chattel slavery and cattle. Cattle mean, you know, cows and such, are traded like commodities. And humans were traded like commodities over 200 years ago, and in some parts of the world today. But back then, when you had Africans in Africa, I mean, show me one American who went into the African continent and stole slaves. It was Africans that were rounding up other Africans, selling them not just to Westerners, but to Asians, those in the Middle East, as chattel, as property. And it was atrocious, and it was terrible. And there's no way to excuse it by modern standards. But if you were to go back into history, what would you have done? What would you have done to stop slavery? And you know why I think you're full of crap when you say, oh, I would have stopped it? It's because what are you doing now to stop modern-day slavery? Slavery exists in many parts of the world. What are you doing now to stop it? So while you try to tear down the United States because of our embarrassing past that was part of a status quo back then, for which you're trying to impose modern-day status quo feelings of morality, that's impossible. Society changes. Who abolished slavery in America and then to the rest of the world? Who stopped the slavery? Was it the Middle Easterners? Was it the Asians? Or was it Britain, France, and the United States, who recognized how slavery was incredibly cruel? And yes, all of the things are true. The Founding Fathers owned slaves. They treated blacks horribly. So where do we go from there? Do we just want to continue tearing down the institutions of this country, instilling these notions to impressionable young minds in elementary school, middle school, and high school, that through the 1619 Project, the United States was built on slavery. Slavery can be conflated with capitalism, and thus both are equally bad and should be abolished. Systemic racism implies that racism is inherent in the system, and thus the system needs to be challenged, and if not just seriously challenged, completely brought down. So I have some major issues with that, and if you want to show me why the path that we're on is the correct one, why the 1619 Project, despite over five historians writing a consolidated letter showing all of the mistakes the 1619 Project has, the fact that they had to issue over a 500-word correction, the fact, I mean, I can't believe it won a Pulitzer Prize, but I'm not surprised. If you want to show me why that is the true history and why we shouldn't also teach the context of slavery at the time, that there were more Europeans enslaved than African Americans throughout the United States, you know, why is that so forbidden to teach that I guarantee most of you have never heard that statistic before? You're fed a very narrow line, and it helps to shape your perspective, and it explains why you feel the way you do about America, why you feel the way you do about Republicans, and to a lesser extent, why you feel the way you do about Trump. And I'll hand it over to Joe. I know you probably have things to say. Go ahead.
No, I love everything that you said so far. Like I say, for me, it's more about introducing ideas and why it is I vote normally with a Republican bend to it, with why it is I like Trump, what it is that they're doing from a conservative standpoint that has me supporting that particular group. I'm not out here to flamethrow in any way, shape, or form. I just want to have a nice dialogue with somebody as to this is why it is. I think it's a better way to run a country than some of the alternatives I see out there.
Excellent. So I know James is going to be taking callers. I welcome the callers. You guys obviously disagree with probably everything I just said in my opening monologue. Let's hear it. Bring it on. I want to have a discussion. Here's a few rules. Let's keep it civil. Just because we disagree doesn't mean we have to hate each other. If you open with "you're a racist and I got nothing but epithets against you because you're racist," that's not going to be very productive. Can you articulate your rebuttal of everything I just said? Can you bring in any facts? Can you do more than just start a sentence with "I feel"? Can you challenge the notions that I put forth? Because you know you disagree with them. I know you're outraged. Can you do more than just talk to your echo chamber and say how awful everything I said, you know, made you feel, how awful and incorrect it was? Or can you actually step up to the plate and have a discussion and have a debate and understand that it will be uncomfortable, but it doesn't need to be hostile? And what I respect about James is a lot of things. I mean, he's a military veteran. He served in Vietnam. He's had a tough life, and he's done well. But and what I especially respect about him is his willingness to give us this forum. And hopefully it's not just because he wanted to watch the football game. I respect that he and I have had some very tense conversations over the past few months on Nextdoor to the point where I got banned. But I'm back. And he left. I don't know if he got – I think he voluntarily left because he couldn't take anymore. It was getting so frustrating. But sorry, I'm already running out of voice. I need some water. So he is allowing us to take over his show and entertain different points of view, which I think is extremely noble of him. And I don't know if anybody saw the YouTube video about the black man – I think the title was something like "Black Man Goes to KKK Rally." Anyways, there was a black guy who started a friendship with a KKK leader, and I'm in no way insinuating that that dynamic applies here. I am as far from the KKK as a Jewish person could get. But the point of that discussion that he had and the parallel here is that the two sides who couldn't have been more opposite. I mean, James and I disagree on far more than we agree on, but he's willing to come to the table, have a discussion. I mean, most of our next door chats start out pretty hostile, and James is kind of a meme master. He's got a set of particular skills like Liam Neeson when it comes to memes, and he always knows how to just drive that wedge in, and especially when it comes to Trump. Trump feels the same way. I mean, James feels the same way about Trump that I think I feel about Nancy Pelosi or AOC or pretty much any journalist, quote unquote, on CNN. So James certainly hates Trump. I mean, that's pretty much unequivocal. But he's still willing to let two Trump supporters come on his show. And, you know, maybe in addition to him enjoying his snacks and a football game right now on his sofa, he is also hoping that we will say the most embarrassing things that can be taken out of context and used against me. But it's very interesting that we've formed a pseudo friendship to the point where, you know, he knows more about me, about my military service, about my background than anybody else on Nextdoor. I know a lot about his, and we've had this very difficult but incredible friendship where, you know, I know if either one of us ever gets married again, we're probably not going to be naming the other as our best man, but we are to the point where we can disagree. We can even have very heated exchanges, but we can still come back to the table and let the water be under the bridge. Even though we had a very tense discussion last time, we still can have a respectful discussion about an unrelated issue. And I always know where he's coming from, usually, just like he can with mine. I mean, if you know anything about anyone when it comes to politics, you can kind of assume that you know everything In other words, if I were to hear you talk about any isolated issue on the left, I could tell how you would vote on every other issue. So if you're against Trump, I can probably tell that you think global warming / climate change / climate crisis is a big concern, and that humans are causing it. And it's beyond doubt that humans are causing it, and that we should be throwing large sums of money somewhere between what Trump wants to spend and what AOC wants to spend. And because the ends justify the means, you know, who's to say that we're spending too much money? Well, there are definitely voices that would say we're spending way too much money for the amount of benefit we're getting. And there are books to show that we could spend our entire GDP every single year, and the best hope we could hope for is to prolong the inevitable by about 6 months to 1 year. We're not going to stop global warming. We're definitely not going to reverse it. We're going to limit the rate of increase of surface temperatures. Now, what do we want to give up to try to limit what is inevitable? Do we want to spend all of our GDP, which is impossible, but let's say we do. Let's say we want to spend all of our GDP, over $10 trillion a year, on combating global warming. What do we have left to pay for the precautions? What do we have left to build the seawalls? What do we have left to pay for air conditioning units, for rest homes, for nursing homes, for the poor, for people who can't cope with the heat? Nothing. So instead, and here's another shocker for some of you who never talked to conservatives, maybe we should spend far less of that money on the low-hanging fruit. In other words, spend the money on the prevention. Spend the money on, well, if you think that these forest fires are being caused by global warming, spend the money on thinning out the underbrush, which we should have done in California. And now we're having record forest fires, and we conveniently get to blame it on global warming, which all means politicians in power get more power, they get more money, and who's to say that they're spending too much, because this is for the global good. It's similar to how everything is couched in racial terms now. If you can push forth a Marxist agenda under the guise of it being about racial justice, who is to push back on you? Who can say, maybe I think the nuclear family should remain intact? Maybe I think capitalism actually does have benefits not only for the rich, but for the poor. It's been the number one health benefit for poor people who can afford to move out of the fields, like in China, into shelter, who can afford to pay for medical care. I mean, show me where the USSR, that was a great idea. It was perfect everywhere except for practice. So show me where that would have been better off. You know, show me where countries like Venezuela, when they were being touted for, you know, their democratic socialist miracle years ago, why don't they talk about Venezuela so much anymore? Why isn't that not touted anymore as the paradigm of responsible socialism? Did something happen? I mean, Joe, did you hear about anything happening in Venezuela? Is there something going on there? No, you didn't. Venezuela is, I don't want to use a Trump term that starts with S and ends with Hole, but you have people, politicians, who had an outstanding revenue source. And as is typical with socialist policies, it's always easy to spend other people's money and overpromise. And if you can just avoid those financial payments until you get out of office, you're good. You get all the praise. You spent other people's money, but nobody cares about that. Now, that reminds me of a Thomas Sowell quote. Why is it greedy when we say we don't want to spend our own taxes on poor people, but when poor people say they want to spend our money, that's not greedy? Where do you reconcile that? James, and hey, Joe, if you want to get any words in here, I will happily let you talk. Otherwise, I will not shut up.
You're doing great.
Well, one person thinks so. That's probably – well, maybe actually both of us. I'm doing outstanding. I guess there's nobody calling in, so I assume silence is consent, as James likes to say. Oh, wait, not context. In other words, not the sexual context. Let me explain. What he means is that if people
Can you hear me, Nick?
Hey, Dave. Yeah, I was just about to explain what I meant by that quote.
I'll let you get back to the quote, but I want to ask you something because you brought up the matter of slavery. And
okay.
We also, I think the last time that we talked on the show, we talked about your ethnic background and the things
mm-hmm.
that, you know, okay. So you're through times of slavery also.
Of course.
And
what Jim's talking about is I'm Jewish. I mean, it's okay to say.
Okay. So when the Jews were kind of dispersed all over the world through, it might not have been slavery per se. Let's say it was more like persecution, more like the Puritans and the Pilgrims. But anyway,
mm-hmm.
you were separated and you... If I'm correct, now I might be wrong, but I believe the original ghettos were Jewish communities.
Mm-hmm. In many places
okay.
of the country and the world, yeah.
Right. So why is it okay, or why was it okay after World War II,
mm-hmm.
That we give the Jewish people their own land? Not only do we give them the land, but we also give you weapons to defend that land, and we kind of put in place a lot of laws to make sure that that land still existed because you were moving into very hostile territory. Now, I'm not saying that black people should be, you know, given, you know, Texas or anything like that, but what I'm saying is, do you really think that do you really think that when every other group that has been persecuted or prosecuted by Americans, including, you know, you can go back to the Japanese internment. I mean, you know, yeah, that was a bad period. But after the war was over, we gave money to build the neighborhoods. We gave money to build houses. We did all of that. Any country that America defeats, quote unquote, in war, the next thing you know, they are the most prosperous country in that particular area. So why is it okay to give all our resources to all these other countries and so-called people that have been persecuted? But when the American black man asks for it, we're greedy or... You know, well, that was just the way things were back then. Now I'm leaving again because
mm-hmm.
I go back to watch. So you can kind of.
All right, yeah, I can address that.
So I mean, I can, you know, I can still hear you. So why don't you chew that up? Because you kind of ran through that, you know, in your first part there. So why isn't there a parallel between blacks and the other areas of persecution?
Sure. So 2 points. Israel, the history of Israel dates back thousands of years. And let me make sure I'm off mute. Okay. So Israel, I mean, the Jews have a claim to Israel. Now, I'm Jewish, but I'm not religious. I had a bar mitzvah, but I'm not a practicing Jew. I am agnostic, if not atheist. That's certainly a discussion for another time. I would like to be convinced that God exists, but it's hard for me to reconcile that with lack of evidence. So I don't want to get into the religious argument because those never go anywhere. There's no factual basis to refute one religious argument with another. But what I can say is the Jews were given they weren't given a country. They were given a plot of land, and they were given the ability to defend themselves because basically as soon as they got that worthless plot of land and started developing it, they were attacked and they knew that there were more attacks coming. I mean, the Palestinians and Jews got along at first, and then the Palestinians realized this could be a great cover to hide the fact that the Palestinian people are actually better off with the Jews than they were before. They have infrastructure, they have medical care, look at Israel. Have you ever been to Israel? Go to Israel. and look at how the Palestinians, in many cases, have as many rights as Jews, and there's places where Palestinians can go where Israelis can go. A lot more. A lot more. Now, that's not to say the Palestinians have it fair. It's not to say the Palestinians have an equal outcome. It's not to say that the Palestinians have an equal opportunity. But the Palestinians are an Arab Muslim people. They certainly have more allegiances with their neighbors than the Jews have. Why do you think their neighbors are so reluctant to help with the Palestinians? The Jews have to fend for themselves. They have the United States as a staunch ally under Trump, a very unreliable ally under previous administrations like Obama. And they have created so many benefits that you all enjoy. Everybody listening enjoys benefits that come from Israel. If you don't, then you need to get rid of a lot of your pharmaceuticals. You need to get rid of a lot of the components in your cell phone and stop being such a hypocrite. You don't get to hate Israel and want to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel while you still enjoy your Snapchat, while you still enjoy your GPS. In other words, look at some of the core components for some of those programs and hardware, and it came from Israel. So it's an amazing country, and it's very easy for us to focus on Israel's retaliation instead of the instigation for why Israel acts the way they do. So when you have somebody, your neighbor, who is more concerned about your death than the life of their own kids, how are you going to win that battle? Are you going to give them part of your property, and you think that'll appease them, and then they'll stop? You really think that'll work? Has it worked? Israel's done that more than once. Did it stop the terrorist attack? No. It emboldened them because they realized these attacks are working. Terrorism is working. Why would we stop something that actually brings Israel to the table and gives us things? Let's just keep going with these rocket attacks, with suicide bombings, with strapping bombs to our children, with pretending that we need medical help so we allow the ambulance to go through the choke point and the checkpoint so then they can detonate into downtown Jerusalem. Why would we stop doing these things when Israel is showing us that it works?
Yeah. But Nick, we have pro-Trump supporters, and you're one of those guys that likes video evidence. We have Trump supporters at a march in Charlottesville saying Jews will not replace us.
Okay. Oh, wait. So Trump condones that? Are you saying they can like Trump? Trump can't stop that. But if Trump echoes their sentiments, then we have a problem. So did Trump say that he aligns himself with anti-Semitic white supremacists? Because if he did, then I'm no longer a Trump supporter.
He said there were, and I know
he said
went to
good people on both sides.
Right. So that means that some of those people that are shouting Jews will not replace us, some of those people are good people.
No, that's not what he was saying. His argument was the fact there were people there defending the fact that they didn't want a statue torn down.
We're not talking.
And they
have
every right to be there.
I didn't say that they didn't have the right to be there. What I said was, they said whoever it was, and you're in a crowd. You're all marching together. There was no COVID. You didn't have to stand 6 feet apart. Someone, more than one person in that crowd, was saying Jews will not replace us. They didn't put tags on them. They didn't put crosses on their forehead. Kept marching in a line. So therefore, in other words, why wasn't someone stopping them or saying, this is not, we're here to talk about statues. We're not here to talk about Jews. How do Jews will not replace us reflect upon we're tearing down statues? When Black Lives Matter says, you know, we're tearing down statues, then they're a racist, riotous group. But when this same group says Jews will not replace us, I know you guys are going to come up with some excuses, so I'm going to bow out again.
Yeah. So what people say, what people mean, and what they want Trump to have meant, which unfortunately he didn't mean, which is clarified through the context. They say Trump said there were good people on both sides, and clearly he's talking about one side is the neo-Nazis, and those are good people, and then the other people are the protesters. Now, that would certainly be a slam dunk. The only problem is it's just not the whole context. So let's look at the whole quote. You had some very bad people in that group. You also had some very fine people on both sides. You had people in that group. Excuse me. I saw the same pictures as you did. You had people in that group that were there to protest the taking down of them, a very, very important statue, and the renaming of a park from Robert E. Lee to another name. So he was talking about the people that were, just like Joe said, that were there to tear down the statue and there to refute it and to fight against it. He doubled down because he knew what the media was doing. You don't get to say, I'm only going to look at that and not look at the follow-up context. You get to do that if you're trying to be disingenuous. I get that. I mean, that's much easier than actually looking at nuance by just thinking everything is binary. You know, orange man bad, Joe Biden good. No, look at the context and dive a little bit deeper into it. So on April 12, 2017, which was the day that the clash happened in Charlottesville, Trump sent out a tweet, and this is on the record, it's on Twitter: we must all be united and condemn all that hate stands for. There is no place for this kind of violence in America. Let's come together as one. Same day, later that day, he said, we condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides, referring to weapon-wielding Antifa activists who even the New York Times admits became violent in Charlottesville. So you don't get to pick and choose and eliminate the overwhelming context to make your point. If you do, you need to be corrected. So you don't want Republican voters, Republicans, to pick apart the myriad Joe Biden phrases. I mean, if you do, I don't think we have enough time on this call.
How about the Antifa people, what they were yelling and screaming there?
Exactly. So then, I mean, do you think Trump was saying, you know, there were good people on both sides? You think he's saying that he thinks Antifa is good and neo-Nazis are good? Is that really the logical implication you would make from Trump saying that there were good people on both sides? So Trump views basically neo-Nazis the same thing as radical left agitators. Does that make sense? Is that the logical implication? Right? The problem is, you know, people don't want to think past the headline. It makes a great headline for CNN. It doesn't make a great headline if you're trying to write a historical account of what actually happened. Now, I really hope someone can call in, especially when it comes to hate crime hoaxes.
But, hey, Nick, you want to get back to James's question? Why it is about black people given something in regards to this?
Yeah, sure. So,
right?
Okay, so
the
other
James,
point.
I think that was what the premise was, right?
Yeah. He was asking about, like, you know, people that we've conquered tend to get our help. So why haven't the blacks? So interesting question. Why haven't the blacks? Well, first of all, they have. So let's look at what happened in the 60s. So Lyndon Johnson, on the record, is an overt racist, realized that this could be a very reliable voting bloc. Now, never mind that Democrats were the party of the racists, the party of the KKK, the party of segregation. Never mind all that. That's why they don't teach history about the Democrats really before the 19th century. It's kind of ugly, so we prefer to just associate the Republicans with that. So we talk about the noble Democrats, who were always the party of the blacks. Yeah, okay.
I got to interrupt you there again, because remember how old I am. So
you're older
while
than me.
You read, no, I mean, while you were reading about what was going on in the 60s, I was looking at the 60s. So,
there's major racial unrest, but you asked me a question about, like, why haven't we done anything to help the blacks? Like,
But I'm trying to put this in context, because you, when you talk about the Republicans and the Democrats, it was the Southern Democrats that split away from the original Democratic Party. And that was became the guys like Governor Fathers, George Wallace, and people like that. And then they, after they couldn't take over the Democratic Party, they tried to run George Wallace as a third party candidate. And that was when he visited Ohio and places like that. But what the reason why I'm giving this background is because the Civil Rights Act was kind of, to me, and you know, if you want to put it in historical perspective, it was kind of like the Emancipation Proclamation. It wasn't signed because the person that signed it necessarily wasn't biased. It was signed because of political expediency. Because, I mean, remember, you know, in the summer of 1967, America was burning. You know, I mean, I was there. You know, Detroit was burning. Newark was burning. So, you know, I thought it was, to me, it was the stupidest thing in the world. And I had come, you know, I'd have to get into another conversation. But me burning down my house is not going to affect you. You understand what I'm saying? You know, if you're a white homeowner, if you're a white homeowner and I'm burning down my house, then that means I don't have anything anywhere to live. You're still going to collect the insurance that you had on the house. So it wasn't like you know, people were so it wasn't like, you know, the riots really gave us anything, because it actually proved how ineffective rioting was, because we didn't, it wasn't a matter of rioting. But I got a gentleman that is in here, and I'm not sure whether this is, let's see who this is. Hello, caller. Who am I talking to?
Hello, champ. How you doing tonight?
Oh, my man. Nick, this is a gentleman. You will love this gentleman here. This is another friend of our show. He's one of the 1% of black men that voted for Trump. So,
welcome. Yes, come on in. You're in good company.
So it's only
1%. It's more than that.
More than that.
You know why I come? I forgot your name.
I'm Nick.
Not Nick, the host.
Oh, James.
James, I'm sorry, James, for forgetting your name. How could I? But I'm sorry if we're interrupting you.
Thank you for joining us. I would like to hear what you think of what we said so far. We've said a lot of things.
Well, James, know that I'm African American. I'm conservative.
Mm-hmm.
I think very highly of Donald Trump's issues that he campaigned on. That's why I voted for him. And I see what's going on with the media and other politics. You made one point. You talked about the rioting. Rioting is not going to go anyplace, especially with the rioters, because when you ask them what they're rioting about, they can't answer. So
what do you, James, are you going to let us take this one over? Are you going back to your football game? All right, James is gone, so it's just us three now. This is amazing. I didn't think we would be outnumbering leftists on this show. I thought it was going to be like how it always goes. It's me against 100. We're taking this over now. Everybody's going to listen. Nobody's calling in to argue with us, so clearly everything we've said, all the audience agrees with 100%. Isn't that phenomenal? Take note, James.
Well, there's quite a few black supporters of Donald Trump, Nick. You know the problem is that when they come out, when they come out in the open, they get ridiculed with the racist efforts that's put forth by many black Democrats, many black leftists, and they get ridiculed, threatened with their jobs, and so on and so on and so on. So they quiet. when you find somebody like myself who don't depend on anybody, they can't do anything to me. I'm not part of the organization. I have a whole different philosophy and a whole different stance on, you know, the things that I have witnessed. So there you are.
So exactly. What do you think about what Lil Wayne said before he had to issue his apology for saying something as egregious as there's no such thing as racism? And he got beat down so hard, not just by the white wokeivists, you know, the woke leftists, but blacks in his own party saying, like, how dare you? I mean, he should be able to speak more for black community and, you know, the black hardships that they face in this country, that you guys face, than any of my white liberal professors or my white neighbors. And, you know, he talked about when I think he was shot. He was rescued by a cop. And, you know, he said that he was, like, on the floor. Police broke down the door. They basically were looking for guns and drugs. But the guy, I think he called him, like, Uncle Bob. He was a cop. He took him to the hospital, and he stood there and waited. And the doctor, he waited until the doctor gave him a good prognosis. And he, you know, Lil Wayne, it changed his opinion immediately. Like, he'd always been, I assume, told, you know, white America is not your friend. America is racist. This is how you have to think. And I think there's a growing number of conservative African Americans that are starting to realize they've been promised, you know, miracles for years, and they've done everything that they were told to do. They voted for a black president, not just once, you know, two terms. They have, there's African-Americans in every rung of society. I mean, black brain surgeon, was it Ben Carson who was a brain surgeon? There's blacks showing that everything is possible. How many black billionaires are there now? Jay-Z, Beyonce, Oprah. And there's a risk, in my opinion, which is on this topic worth less than your opinion, but there's a risk to instilling a sense of victimhood, instilling a sense of hopelessness into young people, and showing no matter how hard you try, you'll never get ahead because of systemic racism. That's one way to teach people. The other way is to say, you know, success is repeatable. You could do what successful people have done. Instead of vilifying them, instead of tearing them down, you could follow in their footsteps, and you can get similar results. So what do you think about, you know, this instilling of victimhood and this learned helplessness that liberals and Democrats have been teaching blacks, especially nowadays young black youth, you know, for years? And has it worked, and should they continue to do so?
Well, it works for those who are instigating those type of views, because they need them in order to maintain the position that they have achieved. When you look at your Elijah Cummings, and I call him Elijah Old Milk Dud Cummings, and John Lewis's, it was good at civil rights. And that was a time when what they'd done was needed. But their policies were not the policies which was favorable to my family and what I would like to see: open borders, high taxes, making children stay in this old, dilapidated, non-performing educational environment that they find themselves in. Those aren't really good policies. And they need to have someone who, depending on those help services. Now, I'm not saying that at some point in time, anyone may find themselves in a dire position where they need some assistance. But that assistance is not for you to dwell on for the rest of your life. And that's what you see.
Or generationally.
Yeah, you see some of these cities, like St. Louis, been Democratic since 1949. Some of them have been Democratic since Moses left. And you look at the conditions that they're in. And at some point in time, people should ask themselves, you know, this just is not working.
There was, you're familiar with, like, Booker T. Washington, right? And
yes.
Yeah, he, and then, you know, so you understand, like, the controversy that he was always in with W.E.B. Du Bois. Like, they were always on opposite sides. One wanted basically to be left alone, you know, not to be held back, but just leave us alone, let us have the opportunity to succeed. The other wanted a much more activist approach. And one of my favorite quotes by Booker T. Washington, it's a couple of sentences. Let me just say it. It goes right to what you were saying about, you know, people in power having incentive to keep people oppressed. So the quote is, "There is a class of colored people who make a business of keeping the troubles, the wrongs, and the hardships of the Negro race before the public. Having learned that they are able to make a living out of their troubles, they have grown into the settled habit of advertising the wrongs, partly because they want sympathy, and partly because it pays. Some of these people do not want the Negro to lose his grievances because they do not want to lose their jobs."
Well, that's true. I'm very familiar with that quote. I remember when Hubert Harrison was speaking, another person, a black person of the Harlem Renaissance era, when he was speaking out and coming up with a different ideology, there was attempts to try to get him fired from his post office position. So the second quote that Booker says, "I'm afraid that there is a certain class of race problem solvers who don't want the patient to get well, because as long as the disease holds out, they have not only an easy means of making a living, but also an easy medium through which to make themselves prominent before the public." And you see that going on today. Your Al Sharptons.
Yeah.
You see that going on with Jesse Jackson before he got to the the physical illness that he's experienced. You see these lawyers out there that run around and chasing police brutality, quote-unquote. I call them non-compliant instances. And that's what you have.
So with all these police shootings, I frequently hear about, you know, black parents having, quote-unquote, the talk. And the talk is when, you know, you are confronted with a police officer, you need to be very careful because they will kill you. Like, don't trust them. They are out to kill you. And that narrative has just grown this year, where the media is focusing on everything but what led up to the altercation. They focus on the response, not the impetus. And why do you think the talk shouldn't be, don't break the law, first of all? Second of all, if you are apprehended by the police, you will greatly increase your odds of survival if you don't run back to the car after you fought the police off, try to grab the knife off the floorboard when the police are giving you an opportunity to save your own life. Like, why is it not fair to look at the actions that led up to these police shootings, and we're only supposed to look at what the police did with almost no context? You know, if you're being pulled over because – go ahead.
That's the news media that's putting it out there. First of all, the people in the community should be having a conversation regarding the respect for authority. Respect for authority starts in the home. Then it moves on to the school and, of course, out in the public. If you have not respected authority along the way before you get to the public, well, you're not going to respect authority in the public, i.e. the police. Another point, police are employees. The people are the employer. It's the civic responsibility of a community to be concerned about how its agencies, its public works agencies, respond and behave when it comes in contact with the public. So you have two accounts that goes on there that has to be held accountable. In this case, more responsibility falls on the people of the community and who they hire and how they hirees are behaving, and also on their children that comes into contact with the police. You're absolutely right. If Blake had followed the first phone call that he had from the court that he wasn't supposed to be where he was, cause and effect, then all things that followed after he was there never would have happened.
Exactly. Now, do you think it's fair? Now, Kenneth Owens got in trouble for doing this with George Floyd. Do you think it's fair to bring up the history of the suspect? I mean, is that relevant when there is a police shooting? Does it help to shape the narrative that it's not that it's an innocent black guy protecting his kids trying to break up a fight, but this is a repeat offender. There was a restraining order against him. He digitally assaulted, to use a most euphemistic term, his ex, the mother, I guess, of his child or a child, while the child was in the bed, you know, sexual assault. These people are being treated like martyrs. And don't confuse what I'm saying with that I'm glad they died. I'm not. I'm like, nobody should die. It's tragic that the cops have to use such a permanent method to deal with a temporary problem. And they tried to use a non-lethal method, just like they tried to use it on Rashad Brooks.
Here's the thing, Nick, and I'm going to see, white folks have got to start telling it like it is and stop cowing down, stop acting like a deer in the headlights of a car and peeing down in your shoes. You see wrong, if blacks knowing, you got to call it like it is. Absolutely. George Floyd should not be a hero for, quote unquote, not only the black community, but any community. Mm-hmm. He was a criminal. Now, you brought up the history of Rosa Parks before they accepted her case to run with it back in the Montgomery bus boycott. Did they not bring up the history of George Kavanaugh or something that he allegedly done when he was a teenager? So you got to fight fire with fire. Mm-hmm. Why should these liberals be able to go back during the time of the parting of the Red Sea on someone, but you cannot go back on the history of a criminal when all of a sudden they find themselves a victim of something that led to prevent their life, not including the fact that they were drug users?
Precisely. And when it comes to Kavanaugh, I think his name was Brett Kavanaugh.
I'm itching here. My head's exploding, but I'm not going to interfere here. But there is a third guy. There's a third man here, and I'm hearing two. I know you can take over a conversation if they let you. And Nick, I know you're pretty good at that too. But I thought there was at least a threesome here. I mean, you know, what happened to my conservative here?
He's my backup. Yeah. Like he's when I run out of voice,
exactly.
He comes in. Yeah,
that's exactly.
James is desperately hoping that like you're a wolf in sheep's clothing, that like you are the rhino, the Republican in name only, and that I brought you on without knowing, and you're gonna
thought about
tell
any
me why.
Of this is My only thought about any of this has been you very rarely ever get told why exactly the cops had to respond to this in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happened to the folks that are in the neighborhood that called the cops in the first place to have them come out? I mean, are they supposed to just be passed on now? Oh, yeah, well, you can call, but we ain't going to do anything because it's the wrong neighborhood? Is that what policing's supposed to be?
Well, that's what they have turned into in Ferguson, believe it or not.
Yeah. Oh, no,
Here's the thing is Ferguson. Ferguson was a majority. Yeah, Ferguson, since the late 60s, blacks were fleeing North St. Louis from crime and mayhem. They moved out to the outskirts county of Ferguson. They became majority population in Ferguson, and they stuck with the tough policing that they had in that city. Now, although 52 of the 53 police officers were white, apparently to the blacks who were majority in the city, it was okay with them. Why is that? Because the policing was protecting their interests. Their interest in their home, their interest in their children's safety, and their safety. They were protecting their interests. And that's what people normally want.
Right. Yep. Absolutely correct.
Well, I don't know if James got what he wanted, or if he's still had a hunger for Joe. Yeah.
How are the Steelers doing?
And you know, the funny thing about that, them same blacks have fled Ferguson after the 2014 Mike Brown incident of the rioting, looting, mostly from outsiders. They fled. And you know, it's a shame. We oftentimes talk about the disparity in wealth between whites and blacks. And we always say that one of the most prominent ways that blacks can attain generational wealth is through a home. Well, these blacks, because of the mayhem that was going on with this concern of rioting and looting, they had to flee their community, thus leaving their homes, not being able to take out the appreciable assets that those homes had grown into. They took a loss.
Yeah.
So how are you going to have the discussion about the disparity in wealth between blacks and whites? Then we have these political decisions that's been going on where you push people out into areas. We're not saying that they don't deserve to be there, but they don't have the capability of maintaining what those areas require of homeowners. And it just brings about a bad situation. It is terrible how the politics play with people. It is really terrible how the politics played with blacks in these particular instances.
So have either of you guys read the book Losing Ground by Charles Murray? Or heard of it? Well, basically the book, he chronicles the decline for the poor in America, especially African Americans, from the 60s to the 80s. And it really exposes how much of a failure some of these, you know, great society programs were to help out the poor, where it started out with, you know, a helping hand, and it ended up being like a lifeline. So it basically incentivized what would be considered irresponsible behavior. I mean, the term illegitimate pregnancies is pretty harsh, but obviously it refers to children born out of wedlock. And people today, especially with some of the principles of Black Lives Matter, how they're against the nuclear family, you know, that's in their mission statement, it's not hyperbole, they seem to think that we need more of this. We need to continue to question the nuclear family, and it would be good for blacks, it would be good for society. One of the most powerful impacts on the black family, according to numerous studies, left and right, has been the lack of fathers in the black household. You know, they say that a child, I can get the exact statistic, but, you know, a child born without a father is over 60% more likely to be incarcerated. And it has these policies that I totally understand were good intentioned, just didn't play out the way they expected. And if I were to go back into the 60s, and see that these policies were on the books because there was absolutely inherent racial injustice in this country before then. And we still had, you know, the residue of Jim Crow, which, you know, was government-sanctioned discrimination. It's just another illustration of why I'm a small government conservative. Like, the few problems that the government solves, they're usually problems that the government created in the first place. So, you know, abolishing Jim Crow gave the government a big pat on its own back, but they would have been better off just staying out of race relations to begin with. Let people make their own decisions. And I understand that can go both ways. But the more the government tries to meddle in social issues, in the economy, it's not always a change for the better. It's always a change, it's not always a change for the better. So these great society programs that were intended to help blacks, they ended up increasing the rate of fatherless households. They increased the rate of dependency. They increased the rate of unemployment. I mean, they're in the 20th century, early in the 20th century, blacks had lower unemployment than whites, and it started to change before the 60s, but it really flipped after the 60s. And I can see in a microcosm what's happening now with government giving out free money and asking for no behavior change in return. There are numerous people my age and younger who can work, who were working, who are being asked to work by their former employers at retail, at coffee shops, numerous other offices. And they don't want to work. They're consciously choosing not to work because the government is not just paying them the same amount they were getting paid to wake up early, to give up their free time, to drive to work, to have to deal with all the burdens of holding down a job. In many cases, the government's paying them more not to work. So what do you think that leads to? Why would someone want to give up more money to go back to work for less freedom in their daily schedule, to not be able to determine when they get to wake up, what they're going to do today, whether they get to go to the beach again, whether they get to spend 6 hours scrolling through Instagram? Why give that up when the government is paying you to stay home and do all those fun things? What do you think is going to happen when the society turns back to normal, if it ever does, if coronavirus suddenly does go away, which I don't think it ever will? What would motivate these people if they can still get some kind of stipend? Now, they will have to show that they're in some way underserved, that they're disadvantaged. And there's a lot of parallels between what young white people, of course all races, but the young white people I see and know, what they're falling into, meaning, oh, I could work, but, you know, it's just not safe right now, or I just can't find a job. I can tell you five employers that would hire you tomorrow unless you have a criminal background. But it's intoxicating.
All right, guys, you're blowing my head off now. I got it.
I can't believe it took this long.
Okay. Now, Bianca, you know my background. We talked about my criminal background, so you know a little bit about me. You kind of learned a little bit, you know, about me. But you see, I have a problem with that because I live in what you would call an impoverished neighborhood, and I found out that I could make more money in a month than the average white man or anybody else. Probably took them 6 or 7 months, maybe even a year to make. No, I had to
tell me what
certain. Well, I was in the street. I'll put it like that. I've done 17 years. So you can figure it out. Yeah. So anyway.
I never knew that. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, no, I wasn't going out to get the job because I can go out and, like I said, I can stand on the corner and I can make more money in an hour than the average dude can make in 6 months, maybe a year. And that was my money. I didn't have to pay those taxes. I didn't have to do nothing else. So all I had to do was protect my property. I had to protect that corner. That's the only thing I had to do. I could have went out and got a job for minimum wage. But I wasn't that, well, for whatever reason, I didn't do that. So the thing that you know, people are sitting around thinking, well, you know, where's my next government check coming from? Well, in some cases that might be true, but that's kind of like, you know, stereotyping criminals. I mean, you know, like if you've ever been in well, I know none of you have, but if you ever go through that particular type of system, if you're robber or dope dealer, you have a certain rank, and if you're a rapist, you have another. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, everything has its purpose. Like, you know, you got a top dog, you got a bottom dog. Just like life, you got an upper class, you got a middle class, you got a poor class, you know, for whatever that means. But I think it's a myth that people sit around waiting for free money. Because free money to a criminal is a whole lot different than free money to someone that's sitting around in a house with sick kids waiting for you know, a check to come, and then there's that the chick there at the table doesn't have a job, walking around with his pants down on his ankles, and he's not thinking of making money illegally or legally. So, which one is worse for society?
Well, you know, believe it or not, the vast majority of blacks don't want no government handouts. the vast majority of blacks do the right, what we would call the right thing in the society.
Yeah,
they go about, pardon me?
I said, thank you. I need it for myself. I might not choose your particular path, but I don't need you. You know, like, I agree with that. The majority of us, we don't want the handle because there's always a chain that comes with it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The vast majority. See, you have about 25.6 million blacks between the ages of 18 and 65. And of that number, that's about 2/3 of the black population. Of that number, you probably got about 5 or 10% of them that's out here doing all this criminal activity. And what they do, they blend in with the other blacks, and actually they prey on them. Because every time you commit a crime against a black person, you are setting them back. In one way, when you're driving on the street, you don't have insurance. You hit some young lady who just got her first car, got her first job, and she's using that car for transportation. Now you tear her car up. Well, you set her back and made it difficult for her to even get back on the straight and narrow or the progress and do what it is that everyone wants to do. And that is what lies the problem. One of the big problems in African-American society is education and economics, and they both go hand in hand. And that's another reason I voted for Donald Trump, because his stand on school choice with vouchers, that where the parents can choose what education, the pathways that they want their child to have, and the money follows the child.
Yeah, hey,
because
let me stop you. Wait, I want to ask James about vouchers. James, why do you think most Democrats are against voucher schools?
You kind of got me there, because I've kind of gotten, you know, at my age, I'm, you know, it's more my grandkids now, and I'm not that much involved in education. But, you know, like I say, you know, to me, you spoke of some things, you know, that were taught in schools. When I was in school, I mean, we were taught about I knew about Tulsa, but I also knew about, other things that, you know, we had civics classes. You knew the process. You knew, you know, I mean, even Sesame Street, how does the bill become a law? You know, nowadays, you don't have those things. Things are made more now for entertainment more than for education. It's something that you put your child in front of so he can see the pretty colors, so you can go to work or you can go to the babysitter, you know, but it doesn't have to have any content. As far as voucher schools, you know, I'm not, you know, I came up in the public education system, and we used to bitch mm-hmm. about that, you know, like how inadequate it was. And, you know, I mean, it's kind of like it's another way to avoid putting money where we should. You know, in other words, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm sure when you were young, you never had the police and metal detectors in your school. I didn't have them in mine, you know. I mean, I was in public education, so I don't see why you should have to have you know, voucher schools, or why you should have to have charter schools.
The reason, James, if I can help you out a little bit.
Go ahead.
The reason why is because the regular traditional school system does not give the options for a learning experience for what's available and what's in high demand. It's more generic. So if there's high demand for doctors, if there's higher demand in aviation, if there's higher demand in other areas – like STEM, then that parent should be able to construct that child's education starting as early as the third year third grade, whereas they are rigorously prepared for the strenuous type of education that the child will receive when he goes on to higher education to pursue those professions. Now, if they aren't prepared right, then when they hit the colleges, they are in for a culture shock. They're in for a shock period because now they realize that they were not properly prepared and now they're struggling. Now, I never blame the child. And being that we're talking about blacks, I blame it on black society, black parenting, and family.
And when it comes to mismatch, a mismatch is a term for students getting into universities where they're not academically qualified, but they've gotten there largely due to affirmative action. That has been just devastating on graduation rates and morale, as well as the stigma. So Clarence Thomas, who I don't understand why he's not, you know, heralded as a hero instead of George Floyd, you know, the first, well, not the first, but I mean, Justice Clarence Thomas, you know, African-American Supreme Court justice. I know why he's not a hero, because he's conservative. But he puts I think it's a $5 stamp on his Yale diploma, because when he got to Yale, he thought, you know, he was high and mighty and very confident. And then when he graduated and finished law school and went to look for employment in the legal field, he realized every hiring manager was assuming he wasn't actually as intelligent as the average Yale grad. He was a product of affirmative action, and they wouldn't hire him. And that was the reason why he put that $5 sticker on his diploma, because he felt that it was so cheap, it was so embarrassing, that even though, you know, he says he got into Yale, he succeeded at Yale because of his academic accomplishments, it was always assumed that he was only there and he only had that degree because of his skin color. And that is one aspect of why affirmative action certainly can help, but it definitely has to be considered with all the damage it can do. And they also, the other thing is similar to what we were just talking about. James, I wanted to ask you, you know, there's a limited amount of resources for schools. There's a limited amount of hours in the day. Do you think the schools should spend equal time or more time teaching things like the 1619 project over STEM education, you know, science, technology, engineering, math? Like, what do you think the breakdown should be between those two subjects?
Well, 1619 is not telling history where it really happened, so I pay no attention to that. I think that the preparation should be for STEM or the STEM subject. Let me give you a counting, and I told James this too. I'm affiliated, being that my grandson is an engineer. He has one course left. He's double majoring at LSU. But the National Society of Black Engineers started in 1972, and its goal was to produce more African-American students in the, quote-unquote, the STEM fields. And they set a goal of graduating 25,000 a year. They had to bring it back down to 10,000, being the reality of what's going on in these elementary schools leading up to college. In 2017 and 2018, at their national conventions, one was in Pittsburgh, the other was in Kansas, you had over 400 amongst the other thousands of students that was the STEM graduate that was there was being hired. Northrop Grumman in 2 years in a row hired over 400 STEM graduates. It was black. Northrop Grumman is headquartered in Mississippi. In 2019, Lockheed Martin hired over 400 off of the convention floor. Amongst the other 15,000 that was present at the convention, I imagine that the other corporations like the CIA, Boeing, Chevron, Google, Amazon, and, you know, Caterpillar, they was hiring these STEM graduates also. So these are young people whose parents have sacrificed and done the things necessary to make sure that their child is prepared and have been exposed to those things pertinent to them becoming as successful as they possibly can be. I've done that with my grandson. That's something that you have to do. And now I'm in a different position, and I don't like to use myself. I can afford to pay for his education out of my pocket. But you have parents who are just as due diligent as I am, but they're coming from a disadvantaged economic situation. And they should have the help in vouchers where they can put their child where they think is best for their overall long-term educational outcome. And, yes, I believe in affirmative action. I don't believe in the way that it has been used entirely. But there should be an affirmative action to make sure that that black child who is well prepared have just as much access and also given just as much options as anybody else. And, you know, here's another funny thing.
But wouldn't affirmative action be more like socioeconomic than it would be race-based at this point, or no?
Well, they try to make it socioeconomics, but you still have the element that people were denied even though they was qualified just based on their race, period. And I'm going to give you another example. Take African immigrants like Nigerians.
Yeah.
Nigerians
they do
have a higher
– blacks and whites. They do better than whites. Yeah.
They do better than – they do better than whites and Asians as educational attainment. And their household income is just as high or higher than whites and Asians.
And they're,
but
and they're
you never
just
see
as
them
black.
Out there.
Yeah.
They're just as black as Wesley Snipes. They're not out there picketing and protesting. So what is it that they are doing? And we're not talking about the ones only that just reached these shores. But we're talking about first, second, mm-hmm. and third generation that's born here in the United States, coming from that stable family. They should be studied to see what it is that they are doing that can be mimicked or copied in other situations.
Absolutely. But it's just like why they don't talk about, you know, Clarence Thomas or why they don't value the views of Thomas Sowell. It doesn't fit the narrative. And, you know, what is the incentive for – I hate to say the NAACP because they did some great things in the past, but what would be their incentive for true racial equality if they really didn't have a need for their own organization? You think they would be happier? I mean, there's a lot of people that are making six-figure salaries there. You think Jesse Jackson would really want to
they
no
would be
more
out of a job.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Sure.
They
so
would
that's
be out
why
of a job. But see, that's another thing. People go to church for 40 years and hear the same thing over and over and over again, and they're waiting to die to go to heaven. So if what we're talking about, whereas the things that the NAACP is out there fighting for, and it's not always the best of things, I have respect for their legislative well, their judicial wing, but some of the other stuff that goes on, like I said, they're against school choice. They speak out nothing mm-hmm. against abortion. You know, black women since 1973, since the Roe decision, have aborted over 21 million babies. Mm-hmm. 21 million. Mm-hmm. You talk about the crime that's going on. Since Memorial Day weekend, the 23rd and 25th of May of this year, up until this past Monday, which was September the 13th, just in Chicago alone in the last 113 days, 2,014 blacks have been shot by other blacks, of which 287 have been murdered, including 10-month, 18-month, 4-year-old children. That is totally, totally ridiculous. And you know, the news media plays a big part in this also. Because at the end of the year, they will report the number that was murdered, which may be 300. But they're not going to talk about what will probably be 4,000 or 5,000 that's been shot.
Mm-hmm. So, like Chicago, for example, they've been on a trend of depolicing some of the most dangerous neighborhoods. And much of that started in the aftermath of Ferguson. You know, it spread nationwide. It was what Heather McDonald coined the Ferguson effect. And, you know, basically there's numerous black intellectuals saying if Black Lives really matter, the best way to save them is to have more police in these high crime areas. So, you know, one of the statistics that's available, and I can provide the source if anybody calls in and asks, which I don't think is going to happen, the crime rate declined from 1990 to 2010 because more cops practiced more law enforcement in more high crime areas. And in the book Ghettocide, Jill Levy, who's a liberal, talks about the shortage of cops leads to a surplus of death in inner cities, where the criminal justice system fails to respond vigorously to violent injury and death, homicide becomes endemic. And, you know, there's numerous studies about what happened in New York. I mean, New York had an incredible reduction in violent crime from where it was, you know, a few decades ago. And, you know, de Blasio has stopped actively policing in many areas, and there's been an increase in violent crime in the most dangerous cities. So, you know, after 2015, it says New York police officers simply stopped actively policing, knowing they cannot trust the politicians to back their play, which makes sense. Like, if you're a cop, why would you be more willing to risk your career and even your life, especially given what happened today, if you are going to face less focus, less punishment, if you just, you know, scale back your policing a bit? You're going to be far less at risk of prosecution if you just don't respond to these calls than if you do get involved and you end up having to use deadly force because you were attacked with a knife, which just happened recently. So in NYPD, traffic tickets and summons for minor offenses plummeted 94% over the previous year. You know, we're talking 2015, so over 2014. Drug arrests dropped 84%. Overall arrests dropped 66%. And it was because of City Hall and de Blasio not backing the police union, the police officers, you know, knowing that he was going to leave them out to dry. And it led to enormous increases in crime. And it's terrible because it's so difficult to rein in violent crime, to get people to go back out and feel that they're safe. And once that's lost, it's lost so much more quickly than it can be regained. And, you know, in 2015, you know, the number of murders was up 6.2%, with the biggest jumps seen in the country's smallest and largest areas. Murders were up 17% in areas with fewer than 10,000 residents. The murder rate in America's largest city jumped 17%, a 15.6% jump in San Francisco, a 25.2% jump in Houston. I mean, this is what 83% jump in Nashville, 62% jump in Oklahoma City, 54% increase in Washington, D.C. And murder jumped over 60% in 10 disproportionately black cities. So, you know, I understand what we're supposed to believe when we watch CNN, when we read New York Times, that Black Lives Matter is actually fighting the trend of black people dying, that they are doing their part to ensure that A, Black Lives Matter, and B, that fewer black lives will be taken. But the statistics don't just show that. They show the exact opposite. How do you reconcile the fact that, you know, after these protests, murder jumped 60% in 10 disproportionately black cities? How is that helping us? How is that helping blacks? I mean, minorities in general. But it just doesn't. Go ahead. I guess want to get some more.
Well, one of the things that you've seen in the protests was a disregard for the police. They was attacking police officers. In St. Louis, you had four police officers shot at a protest trying to contain order. Mm-hmm. They're throwing frozen water bottles at police officers, Molotov cocktails.
Yep.
So when people see this, and I just recently heard that we're they say the gangs in Chicago have made a pact to shoot any police officer. So they have been emboldened by this mess. Maxine Waters gets up in front of a crowd and tells them anytime they come in contact with a conservative, they are supposed to attack them, get in their face, disregard their respecting of them as being human beings. Those actions like that embolden people to act crazy the way they are. And then when you have the president of the United States offer the mayors of a city, offer the governor of a state like Pritchett in Illinois, that we will give you access to the Department of Justice, the FBI, to come in and assist your police with intelligence and other techniques where you can start ringing in some of these crime, these criminals. And they decline. Chicago is a sanctuary city for illegals. Illegals are getting home mortgages using their I-10 number, which is given by the IRS because they're not qualified for a Social Security number. And once they close on their house, they take those documents to the voter registration, they register to vote, and they vote, and they're not even citizens of the United States. That kind of mess, that's what's going on.
Why do you think that?
I hate to cut you short here, but
time flew by.
Give everybody their final thoughts, and I'm glad you guys could join the podcast. I think me and Bianca and Nick, we've all had conversations online here, but I do respect your opinions, and I don't mind you sharing it on the air. But why don't everybody give me your final thoughts? And hey, I know we're having fun, guys, but you got to get out of here. I don't know where you're going, but you
got to get out. What's the Steeler game? What's the score in the Steeler game?
We won 26-16.
All right.
Otherwise, I'd be fuming and raving and ranting. probably.
Yeah.
So it was like music.
Thank God.
It was like music. It soothed the savage beast. So you were safe. But thanks to you guys. Yeah, why don't you?
Well, thank you, Nick, for inviting me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, this went better than I had ever hoped it would. I thought it was just going to be a shouting match. I thought we were going to be hostile. I think that this illustrated the point that we can disagree and not dislike each other. James and I disagree on almost everything, and I really respect him. He's a tremendous guy to let us have this opportunity to literally take over his show and trust us that we weren't going to embarrass him. And he really just wants to give us the opportunity to give the other side, to get that out there. And I imagine that there's all kinds of rage among your listeners right now who've listened to this. I know it's always easier to attack people after the fact. So maybe they're waiting until we get off the air and then they're going to launch their attacks that we cannot respond to. Hopefully that won't be the case. But I hope, if nothing else, this illustrates the point that we can disagree. We all love America. We all do what we think is best for our interests. And we, at the end of the day, we can come together and recognize, even though we disagree on almost everything, we probably have more common ground than we would have assumed had we never spoken. So I hope there's more conversations like this that can occur. And this is a great opportunity. So thank you, James.
Come on, Bianca. I know you're not. Come on. I know you got something for us.
Well, no, it's a good conversation. Like I said before, there is a lot of African Americans that are conservative, and they don't come out for obvious reasons. They're ridiculed. They're castigated. You had a Michigan State Legislature who came out and said she thanked Donald Trump because of his recommendations about the oxycodone, I believe it's pronounced, when she had symptoms of coronavirus, and she said it saved her life. You had another politician there in Georgia, Vernon Jones, who said that he liked some of Donald Trump's policies, and he was castigated by the Democrats. They wanted to put him out of the party. So that is the racism that blacks experience from other blacks that don't go reported. And that's why they don't come out and express their views. it only makes common sense that if you look at a party that's for the poor, well, people don't remain poor all their damn life in general cases. Hopefully not. So when you move up into another economic classification, and along with that is going to come a whole different social aspect along with it, then you won't need what that other party has been offering. You have a whole different point of view for you and your family. It's nothing wrong with that. That's what it's all about. I just fringe to know that there's so many young blacks that won't be able to help make America great to the greatest extent of their possibility because of the political wrangling that goes on with the organizations and the political party itself, that being those Democrats. Thank you very much, James.
Well, you guys have a great night, man. And you know, as I said, if you want to come on again and you know, expand your point of views, make sure you look on the schedule when Pittsburgh is on a Monday night or a Thursday night. No, just kidding. Whenever you want to transform, man, you guys just let me know. And, you know, I have no problem. I'm a gracious host, you know, but, you know, hey, I do get a little heated sometimes. So, like I said.
What? Me too. Me too.
I refuse at this particular time in my life. I refuse to be anybody else. Everybody have a good night. As you said, Nick, I'm sure I'm going to be getting a lot of feedback because I see everybody. Maybe they're sitting, maybe their jaws haven't got up off the floor. I'm not sure. But, So I'm sure we'll talk.
Okay. Go.
Mm-hmm.